A short distance past the Rialto Bridge, we turned into a side canal. Guthrie cut the speed in half as we negotiated turns and edged past motorboats and gondolas going in the opposite direction. After several minutes, we passed under a small bridge and emerged looking up at the Miracoli. Its satin-soft marble exterior glowed in the afternoon light. "This is what it's all about," said Guthrie. "We give parties so we can raise money to restore buildings like this one."
"I think everybody would agree about that," I said.
"Not at all," said Guthrie. "The dissidents have it the other way around. They think we're in the restoration business in order to give parties and mingle with royals." When I quoted Bob Guthrie's words to Larry Lovett later in the day, his reply was emphatic. "That's absolute nonsense." On the morning of the September board meeting in Venice, the week after the gala, both sides arrived at the Monaco Hotel armed with proxies. The Lovett forces were furious from the very start because Guthrie had refused their request to reschedule the meeting for the afternoon so that three board members who were in New York could vote by telephone. As things stood, it would be 4 a.m. in New York when the vote was taken. 10 positions on the board were to be filled, and the nominees would be considered one by one. As soon as voting began, the Lovett faction cried foul again. Guthrie had voted a proxy for a man who had resigned from the board months before. When the shouting died down, Guthrie explained that he had persuaded the man to withdraw his resignation, sign a proxy, and allow Guthrie to accept his resignation at the appropriate time. The appropriate time had not yet come. Lovett appealed to Jack Wasserman, who knew the bylaws better than anyone else, because he had helped draft new ones. Wasserman ruled the proxy valid. The cry went up again when Guthrie produced signed proxies for two people who had just been voted onto the board as new members only minutes before. Guthrie argued that, although the two had signed their proxies when they were not board members, the proxies were not used until they were. Wasserman ruled these proxies legal, too. Lovett's proxies were not wholly above reproach, either. One was signed by Countess Anna Maria Cicogna, the daughter of Giuseppe Volpi, Mussolini's finance minister, and half-sister of Giovanni Volpi. She was over 90, and her mental faculties were known to be failing. Nevertheless, this was the third time in 2 years that the old woman's proxy had been obtained for a Save Venice vote. The first time, hers was one of the surprise proxies Barbara Berlingeri had gathered on Lovett's behalf a year and a half earlier. When asked about it afterward, Countess Cicogna could not recall having signed it and doubted the signature was hers. For the next board meeting, not to be outdone, the Guthries got to her first. They tracked her down in the hospital where she was being treated for the flu, but word of it reached Lovett partisans, who rushed to the Countess and found her to be just as mystified by this proxy as she had been about the one she had signed for them. So they talked her into writing a letter to B. Guthrie, asking to see a copy of what she had signed. "As you know, I have very little memory left," Countess Cicogna wrote. "I cannot remember exactly what document I signed at the hospital or to whom I gave my affidavit." Another year had passed since that letter, and now, despite Countess Cicogna's rather plaintive admission of mental frailty, she had been persuaded to put her name on yet a third proxy. This time, she had signed it for Lovett again, presumably without having any clearer notion what or for whom she was signing.